Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How dangerous is the new Russia? Author Steve Levine's new book explores the deadly conditions within Russia, where the past decade has seen journalists hostile to political leaders gunned down, innocent hostages gassed to death in an attempt to apprehend their captors, and defectors gruesomely poisoned far outside the country's vast borders. And in the center of it all is Russia's former president, now Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who has not only used brutality toward his own political ends, but has largely refused to stop other powerful Russians from employing violence to achieve their own objectives and exact their own revenge against enemies and opponents. The new book is called Putin's Labyrinth, Spies, Murder, and the Dark Heart of the New Russia. Steve, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Really good to be back.
Vladimir Putin was not the world's most compelling character before he rose to power. In fact, you call him a mild-mannered understudy. Can you compare his professional demeanor then and now?
He really grew into the job. He was a gray figure, I would say, one who blended into the woodwork. And maybe that's one of the reasons he succeeded so well, is no one felt threatened by him. He was the ultimate loyalist and extremely loyal even to defending corruption in the Yeltsin regime. And this is the basis upon which he was elevated to the presidency, that he would make sure that the Yeltsins were not prosecuted. Then, within months, and certainly within years, he grew into a traditional Russian tyrant, really. And you see the outcome is the string of murders that deaths that occurred under his watch.
In the book, you have a list of some other mild-mannered understudies throughout history that have sort of evolved in a similar way, or perhaps devolved is the correct word. Is there any reason to believe that he was a fairly decent guy before he had this power under his control?
Well, yes. I think that he decent. He's a cold character. I think he's cold-blooded. And he, as a child, watched spy movies, and this is on the record. He himself discusses it about how he saw romance in that. And I really do think that he is a romantic when it comes to the cold-blooded 007-style spy killer. And so when you say decent, he probably sees himself as decent in a Russian way. He's decent in that he's defending the state. And sometimes defending the state means that people die. People have to die.
He has managed to garner an extraordinary amount of new political power for Russia, including in some way sort of cowing President Bush in the United States.
I'm sorry, say again?
Well, in other words, when the issue came up about the weapons that were pointed sort of toward Russia,
yes,
the Bush administration returned to Putin in some ways with its tail between its legs.
It was, yes. This is a very good point that President Bush, who has made a huge point that we don't go into negotiations, the United States does not go into negotiations, I don't go into negotiations, George Bush, unless there is a treaty, some kind of benefit for us, a big benefit. But in the last few months, Bush, without any idea that he was going to come away with anything, actually flew to Russia to Putin's summer home, and had this tête-à-tête with him, and in my opinion, it was a come down for him, and it was a come down for the United States. He was showing that Putin and that Russia was so important that he was willing to fly not just to Moscow but to the summer home and allow Putin to bask in that glory.
And on the world stage, that buys Putin a great deal of legitimacy that he may not have had before.
He has, yes. he's done very well for himself. I mean, I think Putin is a very disciplined, shrewd, and cool character, not driven by emotions. Someone who knows all the time, very focused on his country and his hand, if you were a poker player, what he's holding there and what he might be able to get out of it. And boy, he's played that hand well. And Russia is very strong now on the world stage because of it.
One serious set of problems that Russia has been dealing with in recent years is the issue of Chechen rebels. And there was extraordinary media play given to the school in Beslan. But one thing that Americans may not have heard as much about was what happened during a theatrical performance, I guess, in 2002 in October. Can you talk about that?
Sure. This is the Nordost Theater hostage-taking. A group of Chechen rebels, about 40 of them, during a musical that was playing during the week in downtown Moscow, during the second act of this musical, there were 800 people watching it, entered the theater and took it over. And over the course of the next 3 days, held these people hostage and demanded an end to the fighting in Chechnya. And at the end, Putin ordered gas, an opiate gas, pumped into the theater. It put everybody out. And then Alpha troops, these are commandos, the Russian commandos, stormed the theater and they executed point blank all of the Chechens, including women who are known as black widows, who were standing there with bombs. Some people think they were fake bombs. And the thing that happened, the collateral damage, is that 129 of the spectators died. And the reason they died is that the government was completely, entirely focused on killing the terrorists and made almost no preparation for how to deal with the hostages. And so 129 of the spectators died from not being given an antidote in time.
Yeah, hospitals weren't even entirely sure what sort of agent these people had been exposed to, so they didn't even know the correct steps to take.
Exactly. For days afterward, the government refused to release the name of the opiate they had used, and so the doctors in the hospital didn't know what to do. And the only answer that the government came up with was, "Well, we saved everybody else." And the message that I came away with was, you know, can you imagine something like this happening on Broadway or on the West End in London, if there were a hostage taking? It seems to me that it's possible that gas might have been used, but there would be ambulances parked around the block, and the priority would be the health of the hostages, and the fact that the priority was showing we are in charge and we will not accept this kind of challenge to the state demonstrates what kind of rule, what kind of a leader Putin is.
There were criticisms even at the time within Russia. One of the journalists who covered this was Anna Politkovskaya. And can you talk, first of all, about her coverage? Because she'll play into the story that we're talking about later on. But she was there for at least part of this.
Right. Anna Politkovskaya was a super courageous journalist, spent a lot of time in Chechnya and was respected as a neutral party by the Chechens. And so she actually was in California at the time that the hostage taking happened. She was summoned to Moscow and she served as a kind of a mediator in the hostage taking and in her coverage afterwards, she was just vicious, brutal in her criticism of the government, the use of the gas, and the failure to allow negotiations to go forward.
So she wrote a book in 2004 called Putin's Russia. Can you talk about what sorts of accusations were in that book and what portrait that painted of Vladimir Putin?
She portrayed Putin as a man plucked from nowhere who became drunk with power and subjected the rest of the country and the people to his idea of what Russia should be, a retrograde idea, almost a medieval idea. So her ultimate message was, this guy is just lucky that he's there, and we're suffering because of that. We've lost our freedom because of him, and Russians, we are not noticing. Wake up, Russia.
One of her contacts throughout the years was the defector Alexander Litvinenko, who later on was poisoned with polonium-210. Can you talk about the sorts of stories that he figured into that she was working on?
Well, Litvinenko also spent time in Chechnya. He spent a lot of time there, and he was a former agent of the FSB, the successor to the KGB. And when she was in London, where she would go quite often to meet the people she used for her stories and sources, she would meet Litvinenko, and he would provide her with very good inside information on how the FSB operated, in Chechnya. And but there was a little bit of an imbalance there because he romanticized the relationship. He was looking for the cover of someone who was as respected and celebrated as Anna was. And so, you know, told everybody that, you know, they were very good friends. Anna, however, looked at him as really a simple source. And according to her, children didn't really like him at all.
Yeah, after she was murdered, she was gunned down, he actually came out and very publicly sort of lamented her death.
Right. I was resisting giving away that part of the story, but now that you have,
people will still read the book. It's fascinating. Don't worry.
Yeah, she was that. Yeah, so Anna was murdered 3 weeks before Litvinenko was poisoned, and there was a memorial for her at a club, a bar restaurant, and he stood up in this presentation. Introduced himself in Russian, and there was a translator, and he said, "You people are wondering who killed Anna Politkovskaya. I will tell you who killed Anna Politkovskaya. Vladimir Putin killed Anna Politkovskaya."
We'll talk a little bit more about the potential that Vladimir Putin killed Anna Politkovskaya, including the fact that she was murdered on his birthday. We'll return in just a minute with Steve Levine. His new book is called Putin's Labyrinth, Spies, Murder, and the Dark Heart of the New Russia. Our telephone number, if you'd like to call us, is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
You're listening listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Steve Levine. His newest book is called Putin's Labyrinth, Spies, Murder, and the Dark Heart of the New Russia. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org. Anna Politkovskaya was a mother of two. She was hardworking, not unaware of the dangers to her life brought on by her work.
Right. So if there's a hero in the book, it's her. I never met Anna Politkovskaya. But I had my own experiences in Chechnya. Worked with a lot of war correspondents there and really all over the former Soviet Union and Afghanistan. I was shot in Chechnya. But I came to feel very small next to her, hearing how courageous she was. I stopped going to Chechnya because of there was a kidnapping spree. And that's kind of where I draw the line in war reporting. She kept going, and she had a messiah complex. It went pretty far. She was known for going up to drunks on the street and, stay away from my children. If she was with her kids and heard someone cursing, she was, "You're polluting my air." And this is just the way she was. She was a very human person. When she would come into work, there would be a line out of her office and all the way down the hall, people waiting to meet her, to tell her their stories of hardship. And she would report these things, and she really had a great readership. But all of her stories, or most of their stories, had a villain. She called people on their misdeeds. And so she also had a lot of enemies. And nobody knows how many enemies, but a lot. And her children knew. She would tell her children in ways. She would tell her friends, "I know I'm not going to die in my bed. I know that I'm not long for this world." And Marion Pearl, the widow of Danny Pearl, told me she presented Anna Politkovskaya an award, a journalism award in New York. A few months before she died, she told me that she and everybody in the hall understood, as they were giving her this award, that she was going to die. And it was this very chilling understanding. Well, ultimately, somebody got her.
She had promised her kids that she would either cut back on her work or get out of journalism altogether. She was about to be a grandmother.
That's right. So, she was 48 years old, still going into the war zones, her family and friends begging her not to. But she had promised her children, Ilya, who's the boy, and Vera, who's the girl, "If I become a grandmother, I'll stay in Moscow." And her daughter became pregnant, and she spent the last few months of her life helping her daughter get ready to give birth and make a home. And in fact, her last hours before she died were spent trying to find a sink big enough so her daughter could bathe the baby. And Vera, the daughter, was out looking for that sink, and she was, and they were trading phone calls. Do you want to hear the how that happened?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So she had been poisoned on a story she went on, the Beslan massacre on a plane that really had devastating effects on her health, and she would tire easily. And around 3 p.m., Vera told her by phone, "Hey, listen, we've looked enough for the sink, and we'll find a sink, and why don't you go home and rest?" And Anna said okay, and she did. 10 minutes later, Vera tried to call Anna, and the phone didn't answer. And then her brother called Vera on the cell phone. You know, I just called Mama, and the phone doesn't answer. And Vera said, you know what? Remember the poisoning? You don't know. You know, maybe she's fainted, or you know. So why don't you drive over there and see? And he was near the apartment, and he went over there, and her phone and Vera's phone rang just a few minutes later. They've killed Mama, and later it came out. There was a camera at a bank across the street, and a man had hidden in wait for her in the shadows on the bottom floor of her apartment building, and she was going up and down the stairs in the elevator bringing groceries in. She came downstairs, the elevator doors opened, and the man fired 3 shots into her torso. And when she fell, he walked to her and fired a 4th shot into her head.
And this was Vladimir Putin's birthday.
Vladimir Putin's birthday.
Did the timing of that escape anyone's notice?
No. It was noticed. And one of the analyses of what happened was not that Putin had ordered her killing, but that it was a gift by some gang.
Currying favor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. My guest is author Steve Levine. He will be appearing tonight at an event hosted by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth that takes place at 6:30. You can find information about it at dfwworld.org. The book we're talking about is called Putin's Labyrinth, Spies, Murder, and the Dark Heart of the New Russia. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hi. It seems like Putin is really close to achieving a dictatorship. I'm wondering if you couldn't discuss what other power centers there would be within the Duma or the military or the oligarchs, some other groups that would challenge his power, and if you could also comment on the status of political parties out there. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for that question, Bert. Over the last few years, Putin was in power for 8 years as president, and now as prime minister. He took away the power of the other power centers, meaning the 82 governors around the country, the parliament, the Duma, called the Duma, and also of businessmen. Businessmen had a huge influence on power and empowered his own clan. And who is his clan? His clan is FSB, other agents, to a lesser degree, generals from the military, businessmen who he has empowered, his favorite businessmen, and then people from his hometown of St. Petersburg. And you know, Kremlinology is an old field. It's an old science. It's an old art. It's probably more of an art than a science. And, you know, we try to peer in there and what's going on. We don't know exactly what's going on, but it is assumed that among these various groups, there is a power struggle. And in fact, one of the things going on, one of the things that people think is that right now, even though Putin retains a lot of influence and power as prime minister, constitutionally, he does not.
I want to clarify for just a second. In the question of the governors and the parliamentarians, what he did actually was reformulate the law so that they are now appointed by, in his case, it was the president, and now he controls the president. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Thanks for explaining that. Putin, during the Yeltsin era, exactly, power had devolved to the regions, and Putin took it back and created a vertical structure, and he calls it the vertical. But now that you've got this kind of semi-confused situation with a new president, Dmitry Medvedev, and Putin as prime minister, there is a struggle going on. And what is the struggle? The struggle is who's going to control the wealth. Ultimately, it's money. Who controls the biggest enterprises.
Well, Medvedev clearly had that strong loyalist streak that got Putin himself where he was. Is there any question whatsoever as to whether he is entirely happy to have Putin pulling the strings, or do you sense that there could be some tension there that is not publicly discussed?
The tension that one feels is an intuitive one that would be based on history. And we know Anwar Sadat was not Anwar Sadat when he was with Nasser, and Mubarak was not when he was Sadat's understudy, and so forth and so on in history. These men are in the shadows. They're meek. They rise to power and they become bold. And so one presumes that, Medvedev is president. At some point, he's going to, to fill in that suit and want to act like president, but he hasn't given any sign of it at all. This is all intuition.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is author Steve Levine. His new book is called Putin's Labyrinth. Let's speak next to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Steve. My question is this. It's clear that he has to have some sort of economic base for his power, and I was wondering, is Putin a free market supporter? Does he partake in cronyism? What are his economic policies? And then to follow that one up, has the median, not average Russian, because I know averages can get distorted, but the median Russian, the guy, middle class, have they improved and seen their wealth increase during Putin's years? Thank you very much, Steve. Take care.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, John. This is exactly the basis upon which Putin is able to build so much power, is that he has made Russians richer than they've ever been. And not just there, of course, there's the cream of the crop, the billionaires, but the average Russian is living better than they ever have in history, not just in post-Soviet, during the Soviet, but ever. And so that makes him popular. And the suffering that Russians had during the Yeltsin period, the poverty, the humiliation, they associate that with democracy. And so the fact that they don't have democracy means nothing to them. And maybe it means something, but not much. And the main thing is that they get what the average person anywhere in the world gets, and that's they're able to live all right, send their children to school, and hope something better for them. The first part of your question regarded cronyism and wealth. This is a exactly how Russia operates, so that you can have the respect that one gets from being in power, but the other side of respect is you have to have wealth. Other people in other sectors do not respect you unless you're wealthy. And so although we don't see what Putin has in the bank or how he's set up, does he have a villa in France, one presumes that he's very well set up, and all of the people around him, and one of the presumptions is that he has got a piece of two or three of the oil companies and Gazprom, the natural gas company.
Let's talk about that, because clearly oil and gas is at the heart of Russia's new economic success. You have the Russians sort of injecting the flag on the floor, the seafloor below the North Pole, which is a sign of their plans to continue mining oil and gas from there. Is the Russian economy now diversified enough that if, in the apparently unlikely event that oil prices were to fall far below where they are now, that the economy would remain fairly robust?
Well, no. It's not diversified. Two things. One is that the government claims that it can continue operating, running the country, all of the various benefits that are given to the people, with oil at $39 a barrel. So here we are at 135, wherever we are today. So they're doing fine on that score. But I think that there's an unfair kind of insinuation about Russia, and that's that somehow there's something wrong with it basing its projection onto the world stage, the explosion of its economy on energy. Well, energy is what it has, and it's making the best of it. It could do better at diversification, but I think that there's nothing inherently wrong with doing everything you can based on what you do have.
And they're not charging anything more per barrel of oil than oil and gas companies that are here within the United States.
Exactly. And in fact, at home, they charge less.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Patrick in Richardson. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I just want to say that your guest is just very interesting and your show is wonderful as always.
Thank you.
I was going to ask your guest if he could speak to the fragmentary allegations that are kind of surfacing or finding their way to the public about possible pedophilia charges against, Vladimir Putin in regards to the academy that he attended before the KGB. He had some sort of incident that occurred, and then there's also there were also reports that Litvinenko had told people that he had gotten a video that had somehow alleged that there is a pedophilia link to Alexander Putin. I take this off the air. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call, Patrick. And in fact, I'm going to put you on hold for a second, Steve, because we have to take a break right here. So we want to get the full answer on the tape that never has materialized, as far as I know. But we will be back in just a minute. My guest is author Steve Levine. The book that we're talking about is called Putin's Labyrinth, Spies, Murder, and the Dark Heart of the New Russia. You can meet Steve tonight at an event sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. It takes place at 6:30. There's information about that at dfwworld.org. If you want to jump online and join our conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, imagination and curiosity, sharp.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1, I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Steve Levine. His newest book is called Putin's Labyrinth, Spies, Murder, and the Dark Heart of the New Russia. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, Steve, we had a caller asking about Litvinenko. Alexander Litvinenko made a lot of accusations about the fact that Vladimir Putin might be a pedophile and, in fact, claimed to have physical evidence, some kind of tape or photographs or something to prove this.
Right. So Litvinenko was a very obsessed critic of Putin, and the most extreme allegation he made against him was this one, and it gained some credence because there was an incident during one of Putin's public appearances where he lifted a boy and kissed him on the belly, and somehow this was seen as evidence that maybe Litvinenko is right, and it just
every
also
grandpa in the world is
does this and sort of, but anyway, it so he alleged that he had a tape, he had a videotape that would prove this, but he never produced this tape, and his co-author Yuri Felshtinsky told me that, there was no way to know exactly what Litvinenko was up to, that in the end, Litvinenko always behaved exactly like a deep undercover spy, which was maybe he did have a tape and he intended to release it. Maybe he didn't have a tape, but he said he did because he hoped someone would give him a tape. Or maybe he just wanted to badger Putin.
And whatever accusations you yourself might make about Putin as an individual and as a leader, you don't think there's necessarily any credence to this accusation?
I think it's untrue. I think it's one of those hand grenades that Litvinenko lobbed, and there's no way to take that seriously. And I would never even repeat it. I discuss this in the book, but not in a way that giving it any credence.
Why kill Alexander Litvinenko with polonium-210 instead of, as you write in the book, just shoving him in front of a train?
I explored that. I explored it, meaning just personally, look, because it's so bizarre. You want to kill somebody. Why not just kill them, as you say, shoot them, stab them, push them in front of a train? What I was told, and I came to believe, that ultimately what the Russians are all about, the KGB is all about when it has assassinated somebody, is not being caught. Now, if you stab somebody or you shoot them or you push them in front of a train, you're still standing there, you the assassin. And that makes your escape difficult. And so the Russians have traditionally chosen methods where they deliver the death, if it's poison or a pellet, whatever, it gives them some time to escape. Now, this is going to an incredible extreme, and that's the other thing, is that Russians are known for this incredibly intricate way, complicated, labyrinthine, to use that word, way of killing people. And so, I've got another character in the book, Nikolai Khaklov, who in 1957 was the first victim of radioactive poisoning, but he lived, and I interviewed him, and he told his story, and so some scientist somewhere somehow knew about polonium and what its atomic properties were, what its half-life was, that it was it was undetectable using traditional devices in airports, and so you could get it into the country, and not threatening to the actual assassin, meaning it's only fatal if you swallow it or you breathe it. It's okay if you get it on your skin. And he told, the mastermind of this death, of this murder, that this is, the ideal weapon. And then it was used.
And meanwhile, you have Litvinenko was the first one to suspect that he'd been poisoned. He's in the hospital and they're running this battery of tests on him for a million different things. And he's screaming, "I'm a defector. I bet I was poisoned." And they said, "Oh, settle down and sit back." And in fact, he was right.
This is one of the an extreme version of the boy who cries wolf. Litvinenko's recurring theme is him claiming that someone's trying to kill him, people are after him, and then people not believing him. And in this case, his own wife, Marina, said, "Oh no, you must be wrong. You're not poisoned." But then starting to believe it after a few days when his hair was falling out, and then telling the doctors this. But who would believe that? I mean, it's although it was up to them to test everything, but he claimed from the very beginning, in fact, within hours of getting sick and vomiting uncontrollably, he told Marina, "When I was going to school, to KGB school, one of the lessons was how to use chemical weapons and the impact of chemical weapons. and I think that I've been poisoned with a chemical weapon.
Well, it's like that old joke, you know, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean people aren't out to get me. I guess in his case it was true. He does not come across as a choir boy in your book. And in some places he's become this sort of heroic figure because he was, you know, poisoned by the FSB. Can you talk a little bit about him?
I think that, yes. Litvinenko, I found him to be a fascinating character. He, like a lot of people, wanted to be more and bigger than he was. And he chanced into a friendship with Boris Berezovsky, the billionaire Russian oligarch who was also an enemy of Putin's. And he grew up in a single family, sometimes no parent at home, with a grandfather, and he never felt loved. And so one finds him throughout his life seeking acceptance. And what he did was seek to climb onto the world stage through his decision that Putin was an evil man and should not be the president of Russia, and ended up defecting and being like an actor. He was in the end a great actor. And taking his obsession with Putin to such a degree that it took over his life and brought actors into his life who were much larger than he was, and it all swallowed him up.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is the author of Putin's Labyrinth, Steve Levine. Let's go next to Sherry in Dallas. Hello, Sherry.
Hi. Fascinating discussion you're having. My question to the author is: are you at all nervous for your own safety, given the poisonings, the executions of journalists and such? I mean, it seems like almost like a dangerous topic to write about.
Have you thought about that?
Well, thanks for your concern. I do get that question a lot, and I've thought about it, of course. I didn't eat any sushi when I was in Moscow reporting on this story. I'm joking, of course. I took the advice. There is a superb British investigative reporter in Moscow named Mark Franchetti. He's been there for 12 years in Moscow through all of this. And I asked him, Mark, why aren't you dead? and he said his view was that you cross the line when you either get very personal about somebody, or you get in the way of a business deal. And that really is that line. There is, in fact, in Russia, that's the ultimate message. In Russia, there's a line, and if you cross it, you could be subject to murder. And if you are murdered, the killer is not going to be brought to justice. These people, the people who I profile in the book, all of them crossed the line. And some of them knew they had, some of them didn't, and some were just in a unfortunately in a situation where somebody else had crossed the line, and they ended up the victims.
We have a minute or two left. I'd like to talk about the American-born editor of Forbes Russia, Paul Klebnikov. And you characterize him as someone who never fully understood, although he loved Russia and was fascinated by it, and it was his sort of ancestral home. He never fully understood the climate in which he was reporting.
This is the kind of the contrarian story, is that Klebnikov, born in New York, of Russian ancestry, and through his reporting, he was a crusading reporter, and he was after actually the same thing that Putin was after, which was helping to recreate a great Russia, championing a great Russia. But what he did was somewhere along the line, he crossed that line, and he ended up being shot down dead outside his office in Moscow. And his relatives told me that he didn't belong in the same group as these other people in the book because he wasn't a dissident. And I disagreed because I said, no, he belongs there because he crossed this line and he didn't know it. In fact, he thought he really knew this Russia that he was championing and telling critics, you know, to chill out a little bit. But in fact, he didn't know that Russia. And in the end, he was killed by it.
Was Forbes Russia very structurally different from the Forbes that we see in this country, which is clearly pro-business and would, I would think, avoid really sort of irritating one business or one industry over the other?
It's very similar to the U.S. edition. Among the allegations out there of who might have been responsible were that he put out a list of the, you know, the top richest, the 100 richest Russians, that maybe some of them wanted to stay under the radar screen, someone there. Two, Boris Berezovsky, the billionaire. He had written a book, Godfather of the Kremlin, a fantastic investigative book. Maybe it was Berezovsky. And three, he had written a book called The Barbarian, and it was about a Chechen leader, and one of the allegations is that Chechen may have had him killed.
So what do you think happens, Steve? Medvedev has 8 years or 7.5 left, I guess. Do you see Putin putting plans in place to also control the next president?
Putin himself could be the next president.
Oh, there can be a break and then he could come back in.
Sure, sure. No, when you talk to his guys, they speak in terms of Putin and his group being in power through 2032. Yeah. So they plan to be around for a long time and he plans on it. And, you know, there's a lot of hope that's out there that Medvedev somehow, because of the way he speaks, a little bit softer than Putin, that he'll have a better relationship with the West. And I think it's going to be exactly the same. Putin, Medvedev speaks softer, but Putin put him in that place for a reason.
Like Raul Castro.
Yes.
Steve Levine, you can see him this evening at 6:30. There's an event sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find information about the event at dfwworld.org. The book is called Putin's Labyrinth, Spies, Murder, and the Dark Heart of the New Russia. Steve, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.